warm welcome to this episode on Hope and the Long Game, Leadership in an Age of Urgency. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy of Leadership, known by its German acronym as the IAF. Based in the quaint town of Gummersbach near Cologne, the Academy develops leaders working for partner organizations of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation for Freedom. They're from all over the world, bringing together experts, opinion leaders, committed young liberals, and aspiring leaders to share specific experiences and knowledge, to develop themselves and their organizations, and to explore liberal solutions and responses to public policy challenges. There are many of those. My name is Clinton De Prier, and in today's conversation, we explore what does it take to lead with vision when the world demands immediacy? How do you stay anchored when cynicism feels more rational than hope? Joining us in this conversation is Brent Colburn, former campaign communications director for President Obama, and might I add, a seasoned voice in American public life. Together, we'll explore what it means to lead strategically and honestly and with endurance, especially when the work is slow, the stakes are high, and the outcomes are uncertain. This is a conversation about hope. It's about the quiet work of staying the course and what sustains leaders when results are far off and pressure is relentless. Welcome, Brent. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I guess seasoned is a nice way to describe all my gray hair. So you know, that's a much kinder word than older. So,
you know, that was not my intention. But, you know, as we say in Afrikaans, if the jacket fits, you know, wear it.
I have earned every one of these gray hairs. I'm very proud of them.
Yes, yes, you have indeed. And as always, a conversation would not be complete without my dear colleague, Marike Groenewald, as co-host for today's conversation. Hello, Marike.
Hello, Clinton. Hello, Brent. It's great being with you. And hello to everybody listening.
So, Brent, let's just dive in. And let's start with now. Can you share with us a little bit the highlights of your own journey to leadership? We heard a little bit of President Obama somewhere. What does that roadmap look like?
Sure. So, this is the part of every podcast that feels like a job interview. So I'll give you a quick rundown of my resume.
So there is no job here. Let me just be clear.
It's very low stakes. But I think of my career in sort of chapters. And so my first chapter was really doing political campaigns here in the United States on the Democratic side of the aisle. So that started with the Al Gore campaign in 2000. I was coming out of graduate school where I studied public policy and sort of fell into the opportunity to work at a very entry-level job for the Gore campaign. And that kind of had me, like I'm sure a lot of your listeners who've gotten into public service or into political life, you kind of catch the bug on your first campaign or your first chance to work for an elected official. And you realize that, you know, there's power in being part of something that's bigger than yourself. I also think it's a space, at least in the United States, where you oftentimes can have a bigger impact as a younger person. So, you know, I was 24 years old and getting to do things that my colleagues that had gone into and my friends that had gone into the private sector just weren't getting to do. And that was exciting. The less exciting part was, if you know a lot about American politics, you know, if you started your career in 2000, that meant you spent about 6 years doing nothing but losing campaigns. So I worked for Howard Dean. Some of your older listeners may remember him in the Democratic primary in 2004, eventually worked for John Kerry in 2004 on the general election. So I got to lose twice in 2004, which was a real feat. And in between, sort of worked on Senate races and House of Representatives races. And then in 2008, I was lucky enough to work for then Senator Obama at a very kind of mid-level position on his first campaign. So, you know, our campaigns are structured in a way for president where you have a national headquarters and then the swing states that I'm sure everyone around the world gets tired of hearing about every 4 years, Michigan, Ohio, Florida, each of them has sort of a mini headquarters. And so I ran communications for Senator Obama in Michigan, where I'd done some work before. We won. I finally got to work on a winning campaign. I'll tell you, it's much more fun than working on a losing campaign. And in our system, that opens up a whole set of opportunities in the government, which started sort of my second chapter, which was serving in government. So I ran public affairs or communications at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which, given the trajectory of things right now, might not even be around if we do this podcast in a year. Also led communications at the Department of Homeland Security and eventually at the Pentagon, running public affairs for the Defense Department. In the middle, I took a year off and was the communications director for President Obama's reelect. So worked and lived in Chicago for a year, which was also a win. Again, also more fun than losing. And then I sort of stepped off the political track, though I've stayed involved through friends and informally and as an advisor to some folks, and got into philanthropy and higher education. So I worked at Princeton University, worked at the University of California. Really loved those experiences. You know, I believe higher education, which is also under attack in the United States right now, was also a form of public service. I was very happy doing all of that, and then got a call from a gentleman I'd met along the way who's the president here at Microsoft, where I currently work, joined Microsoft about 2 years ago. So it's been interesting to have sort of this new perspective on things as we navigate the world, working at a private sector company, a large multinational. But my role really focuses on our intersection with politics and public policy. So it's a lot of the same work, but through a different lens.
Yeah, I can totally see the kind of golden thread running through all of that. It's funny when you were talking, it must feel weird thinking about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, which feels more like it could have been 50 years ago, at least from this side of the world, looking at what we see in America take place. The change is quite drastic. I mean, this conversation is supposed to be an evergreen conversation, but I think for context, I mean, we are recording this on 25 June 2025, and we are right in the middle of kind of an Israel-Iran back and forth rocket tennis. I can only describe it as that. And so there's a lot going on in this particular acute moment, but I think in this stretch of time that we find ourselves in compared to where you were, I'd love to ask you, looking at all of that, what do you think is the hardest challenge at the moment in terms of leadership, whether it's in political work or whether it's in civil society or public life more broadly? What do you think is the key challenge there?
Yeah, I'll kind of answer the question in two parts, because I do think there are some things that are unique to this moment. And then there's sort of this evergreen challenge that if you're someone who works in progressive politics or left of center politics, I think is, you know, we're kind of holding the burden of the second piece that I'll talk about. You know, to me, history is so important. And maybe that's just as I get older and I appreciate all of the work that came before the work that I do now or that I got to do earlier in my career. And it's important not just because we can learn from history, but because it also provides context. So in some ways, you know, what we're going through now is not unprecedented. You know, I think back to the formative years of my political career, which were very much animated by opposition to the war in Iraq, some of the policies of the Bush administration in the early 2000s. You know, I've been involved in public life for 25 years, just randomly, you know, half of those years basically have been with someone in power here in the United States that I supported. Half of those years have been with someone in the presidency who I did not support. And, you know, there's a cyclical nature to it. You know, one side's up, one side's down. American politics in particular tends to have this pendulum swing to it because of our two-party system. And so I guess, you know, to reorder it a little bit, that's the part that doesn't feel unique. And I think the challenge there as a leader, if you're a leader out of power or in the opposition, is how do you keep your constituents, your staff members, your volunteers, how do you keep them engaged, positive, moving forward, focused on what matters? You know, it's easy to get people to want to join your team when you're winning. People like being on the winning team. But in some ways, it's more important to have people engaged when you're not winning, when you're out of power. And that's really, you know, you're asking a lot of people in that situation, right? You know, there can be social costs to being associated with the party that's out of power. You know, oftentimes the professional experiences that you're able to offer I think about, you know, myself and a lot of my colleagues who eventually worked on the 2008 presidential campaign for Barack Obama. There weren't jobs for us in Washington, D.C. There weren't jobs for us that made you feel like you were part of the West Wing. You know, we had to go out and work on Senate campaigns in Michigan or gubernatorial campaigns in Ohio and live in smaller American cities. But that was the training and that was the experience that then armed us and gave us the skills we needed to help Senator Obama win the presidency in 2008. So I think that's the kind of evergreen challenge of being out of power. How do you keep people motivated? How do you keep people engaged? How do you get people excited when you don't have all of the trappings of power? The part that's unique to this moment that, you know, I think we'll look back and historians will really focus on when they think about the second Trump term is, you know, throughout American, you know, at least, you know, modern, recent post-war American history, there have been wild swings in policy and there's been wild swings in worldview amongst the two parties and who's been in power. But there's been a consistent way of doing things, right? So if you think about, again, the Bush administration, putting aside, you know, the validity of the arguments that they made to draw us into the war in Iraq, they still went about that in a very traditional process, right? So they embrace multilateralism. They built a coalition. They went to Congress to get authorization. They went to the United Nations and made their case. You know, that is the way that America has conducted foreign policy, regardless of what that foreign policy is. Again, since 1945, you know, you could have disagreed, and I disagreed vehemently with a number of their domestic policies, say around education, but they did it through the Department of Education, right? This administration, Not only has it been a very dramatic pendulum swing from the Biden administration to the Trump administration from a policy perspective, they also start doing everything in a different way. And I think that makes it harder as the opposition to figure out how to engage, what are the pressure points, you know, where can you have influence? And I know, I'm sure for folks abroad who are trying to figure out how to work with this administration or even push back on this administration, you know, you have to kind of blow up the playbook and start over because they have blown up the playbook and are doing things in a different way. So that's the part I think that intellectually is different about right now and strategically is different about right now.
Brent, it's so interesting that you're touching on that topic because I think if I look at the types of organizations that people listening to this around the world are involved with, I think many of them are coming up against that as a leadership challenge, that their political opponents have thrown out the rule book or has thrown out the rule book, don't play by these kind of standard agreed upon rules that we've come to accept as the norm in the last few decades of humanity's development, and that they just don't know how to respond to that on an organizational level, on a campaign level. Added to that, just the complexity of the world that we're living in, that things are, it's as if we're standing on shifting plates. It's hard to make sense. It's hard to have a sense of stability. Do you have any thoughts that you might share for how to respond to this type of leadership, where you just don't know what this opponent is going to do next and how to respond systematically and strategically?
Yeah, it's a good question. And look, I don't pretend to have all the answers. I think that this is something that you're watching the Democratic Party struggle with here in the United States. You know, in our system, that's playing out through a number of kind of off-year and midterm elections, right? So we just saw the primary just yesterday in New York City for mayor. You know, we have governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey that happened to fall the year after the presidential election in our patchwork system. And so those will be interesting testing grounds. You know, we hear this a lot. I'm sure other progressive parties hear this a lot around the world. When you lose, there's this sense of, well, you know, the other side fights harder, or the other side is willing to do things to win that you're not willing to do. And, you know, I think we need to hear that, right? And we need to take a sober look at our assumptions and our tactics. And if we don't evolve and change how we campaign and how we engage with people, then we're going to be left on the sidelines of this next kind of generation of leadership. That said, You know, I think that there's two questions that we need to ask when we look at changing tactics. There has to be, is it effective? And then the second question that I think in some ways sets us apart from our opponents is, does doing this align with my values? And does doing this align with, you know, the things that I'm fighting to gain power to forward, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, what we can't afford to have happen, even if it's a harder path, is basically to become the opposition in an attempt to, you know, what's the old idea? You know, you don't want to become the monster you're fighting to beat the monster, right? So we still need to figure out new ways to connect with voters, new ways to motivate voters, but we need to do it in a way that aligns with progressive values and reflects the things that we care about, right? Like commitment mm-hmm. to the truth, right? And the fact that you should have fact-based arguments, you know, an inclusive and diverse coalition that brings along everyone, commitment to basic human rights and human values. You know, and then I think at the highest levels, you know, messaging and tactics that are based in hope and not fear, I think is an important piece of what has made the progressive project in the post-war world so valuable and so impactful. It's a harder path, but I think we can't mm-hmm. abandon our values just because we start changing our tactics.
Mm. Mm. And I'm so glad you're using this word hope, because that's where I want to come to next. And that's really one of the core themes of this conversation. But more and more, especially when, you know, Clinton and I find ourselves standing in front of rooms, working with groups of people facing such challenging circumstances, this message of hope sometimes feels a bit like a pipe dream, feels unrealistic. It feels out of touch to speak about it. Now, you've had, on a personal level, I think, on a campaign level, or on a professional level, quite a long kind of road that you've walked with this concept and maybe value of hope. I would say that in recent history, there isn't a campaign that really embodied the message of hope as much as the Yes We Can campaign by Obama in 2008. So could you share with us a little bit about your personal connection with hope as a value, and maybe, you know, working with it, your experience, how it's changed, how you saw it then, how you see it now?
Yeah. So there's this cliche, right? And I think we've even talked about it before, that a lot of times you'll have people tell you when you try to kind of bring a hopeful approach to things, that, you know, hope is not a strategy, right? People love to throw that term around. And let me tell you, look, when you worked for a campaign or two campaigns that, you know, literally your bumper sticker was the word hope, people a lot of times, cynics in particular, or the opposition, would come up and say hope is not a strategy. And I really always bristled at that idea, because, you know, what I think people are trying to do when they kind of deploy that cliche is devalue the importance of hope in terms of motivating change, in terms of leading to change, in terms of driving change in society. And you know, hope is like the necessary ingredient, right? If you don't start there, then everything else sort of doesn't matter and doesn't fall into place. Like, you have to believe that things can and will get better. If not, it's not worth the effort. If not, then you're going to end up in a position that, look, I think some of our opponents would love for people to end up in this position where you basically draw a circle around yourself and your family, and you do everything you can to make sure yourself and your family are comfortable and secure, but you don't project out into the world in a way that can help others and help change the overall status quo. And so, you know, I start with the idea that hope is sort of the necessary condition for success. Now, I think what, you know, my guess is if you went all the way back and found whoever the first person was that uttered the words, hope is not a strategy, my guess is that what they were trying to say is not that hope is not important, though I think that term, that phrase has been hijacked in that direction. I think what they were actually trying to say, which I agree with, is that hope is not an action plan. Like, you can't just hope and then have a good result, right? And I think that, you know, the Obama campaigns and other campaigns I've been a part of are the actualization of that, right? And in some ways, it's almost the connection between the idea of hope and that very powerful phrase of yes, we can. That is an active phrase. We are going to do something. We are going out to make that change. We are going out to take that world that we hope is possible and actually do things to make it come to life, right? And so, you know, if hope is the necessary condition, you then have to have a plan, right? You have to have a way to get from A to B. You have to have people who are committed to going on that journey with you, to adjusting that plan as the world interrupts that plan, because, you know, the God knows the world gets a vote and things change all the time. But so I see that connection. I think truly successful leaders, truly successful organizations, and truly successful campaigns are those ones that are both able to inspire, so enable to, you know, make people see that vision of what could be, to give them hope that things can and will be better, but then are able to connect it to an action plan and a way to get to that outcome, right? A way to actually take people forward on that journey. And so, you know, that's how I think about it. You know, I encourage everyone that I talk to remain hopeful, even in these times that can sometimes feel very, very difficult to have that hope. And in some ways, I look at our opposition, you know, here in the United States, if you think about the things that the right is accomplishing today, those weren't ideas that they came up with 2 years ago. This has been a 10, 20, 30, 40 year journey for them. If you think about, you know, an incredibly important issue here in the United States around women's health and reproductive rights, you know, that is a plan that was put in place 40 years ago. And look, you know, their side often thought that the outcome that I vehemently disagree with, but that they were able to accomplish, it oftentimes looked like that was an impossible task. And so we have to take that same approach. We need to be planning for the long game. We need to understand that just because things might not look optimistic right now doesn't mean that the opportunity to make the changes we want might not be right around the corner. Things change quickly in politics. And so remaining hopeful, remaining engaged, remaining oriented towards action, that's how you set yourself up to actually have an impact.
So it's an odd experience to draw inspiration from people succeeding in the thing that you don't want them to succeed in.
That's exciting. I wouldn't use the word inspiration. I think it's important to learn from your opponents, right? And then, and you know, that is such an interesting case study, because they had a multi-pronged strategy. They had a legal strategy. They had an engagement strategy, mostly through the church. They had, a public relations strategy, right? They had a legislative strategy, an electoral strategy. And, you know, I think if we're going to move the world in the direction that we want on the issues that we care about, we have to bring that same level of commitment and sophistication at the issues that we care about.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. As you're talking about this, the concept of hope and this value of hope, I think there's something unique about the human, the human condition or the spirit or the way that we interact with people. Like, we can detect insincerity or inauthenticity when that hope feels like lip service. And I think sometimes when you speak to people about hope, that's perhaps what they hear is this shallow definition of hope, not the one that says, Eve, that hope is most important when it's easy to not be hopeful. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on what do you think leaders get wrong about the authenticity of being hopeful, that you genuinely believe, but then on the other side, you sometimes get this performative optimism where I think that's what people struggle to connect with. I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah. So I would say a bunch of different thoughts on that. It's such a great question. You know, first, I would just start with the idea that there is nothing more important in leadership than authenticity. And authenticity, that does not mean being the version of yourself you think people will want to see. It means actually being yourself, right? And so, hindsight is 2020. You know, people often look at the outcomes of elections and think, oh, that was inevitable. But if you had told somebody in, 2006, 2004, as the Republican Party was basically winning election after election in the United States, the transformative figure that would bring the Democratic Party back to power was a African-American man from, liberal Chicago who was named Barack Obama, people would have laughed at you, right? I mean, that was until it happened, that was a almost unimaginable idea. And in some ways, President Obama, one of his many superpowers is he is the same person no matter what audience he is in front of, no matter what topic he is talking about. You know, that's also true for people who I voted against who have won in the United States. George Bush, you know, I don't agree with the man on a lot of things from a policy perspective, but George Bush is George Bush every single day of his life, no matter who he's talking to. And look, for no matter what you think about Donald Trump is authentically Donald Trump. He is who he is. And so, you know, I agree, Clinton, you know, people have a pretty good, you know, BS detector, right? And so that's almost the first hurdle. They have to believe you are who you are and that you're not trying to put on a show. So I think, you know, if there's one takeaway for somebody who's out there running for office, it doesn't mean you don't want to be smart about how you talk about things and strategic, but wake up every day and don't try to be something you're not. Be yourself and you know, have pride in who you are and pride in what you bring to the table and your perspective. And you're more likely to have people listen to you and eventually follow you than if you try to fake your way to some sort of outcome. In terms of how you then authentically project hope, you know, I think you need to be transparent and honest with people and still be hopeful. So you can, you know, if you're just brushing aside the urgency and the seriousness of the moment, people aren't going to listen to you because that's their lived experience. They know what's hard right now. They know, you know, they're feeling the economic issues that you may have to help navigate through. You know, they're watching what's happening around the world on television more and more than ever, right? The access to information. And so, you can be honest about the challenge and still be hopeful, right? You can be honest that we may have a very steep hill to climb and still try to inspire people to climb that hill, right? So I think, you know, oftentimes people, I think, you know, they hear hope and they, again, to your question, they think that means they have to project sunniness or somehow try to convince you that the bad thing is actually not that bad. I think it's more important to be honest about what is challenging, and then to try to get people to be hopeful about the fact that even if things are hard right now, they've been hard before, and we've always found a way out of that situation. And that's a reason to be hopeful, giving them ideas and things to do and ways to move forward. That's a reason to be hopeful. But trying to whitewash what's happening, that feels like a recipe for failure, not for success.
It leads me to, well, actually, I think you've answered the next kind of question I wanted to ask, which was, How do you lead a team of people exactly like this when it's uncertain, when you can't guarantee success? But I want to follow that up with a different question, is because I think what precedes that is, how do you lead yourself when it's uncertain? So how do you get yourself then to genuinely, authentically believe hope in hope, or believe that things can get better, so that you can authentically also be that for other people? What do you do when you just genuinely, if you have to be honest with yourself, you don't feel hopeful?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And look, I think there's nothing wrong with having moments of questioning or even moments of despair, right? You know, I think that, you know, there's this kind of great men theory of history, right, that points to these superhuman individuals who have shaped the world. And you know, if you watch biographies on TV or, you know, kind of the movie version of people's lives, it almost always glosses over the fact that, you know, almost everyone who's gained success in any field has had moments where they didn't think they were going to succeed, right? And that they questioned what they were doing. You know, there's this really great story that President Obama tells about in 2000, I think it was 2000, the Democratic convention was held in Los Angeles. And he, at the time, he had run for, I think he'd run for Congress and lost. He was a failed candidate. But he felt like it was important. He still wanted to have a life in politics. He wanted to go to the national convention. And he got to L.A. And for those of you that have been to a U.S. political convention, I'm sure it's similar in other countries. Basically, it's in a stadium or an arena, and you get different types of tickets or credentials that get you kind of closer in, right? So all the way down to the floor or the dais. And, you know, Barack Obama was only able to get a credential that got him into he couldn't even get inside the arena. He could only get into the area where all the concession stands are around the inside of the arena, right? Because he was that unimportant, right? Quote, unimportant. 8 years later, he's accepting the nomination for the presidency of the United States in Denver. And months after that, he's the first African-American and first Democrat since Clinton elected to the White House. So, you know, there will be moments where it will feel like you are on the down and out. And that doesn't mean that there aren't better things around the corner. So I think giving yourself grace to sometimes feel and sit with that lack of hope, I think, is important. You know, I think everybody has their own strategies. You know, I think that the term that's used a lot in the United States is self-care, right? You know, what do you do to make sure that you can just continue to move forward as a leader? And you have to figure that out for yourself. For some people, that's, you know, making sure that you can exercise every day. For some people, that's carving out time to read. For some people, that's taking a vacation and unplugging for a week, right? So you have to be a little bit selfish in this process and take care of yourself. And then I personally, and, you know, we've kind of touched on this a little bit before, I find that when I'm feeling particularly down about things, like finding context and looking to history is super important, right? So there's humans by nature have a recency bias. We tend to think whatever's going on right now is the worst thing that's ever happened. Hardest moment ever in history. And I don't want to discount, going back to the earlier question, I don't want to discount, like, things are hard right now if you're a progressive in most of the world. But it's not the worst it's ever been. I mean, you look back just in the lifetime of my parents and my grandparents, you know, in 1969 in this country, in the United States, there were political assassinations. There were riots in almost every single city in the United States. You know, cities like Detroit were on fire. And, you know, that doesn't mean we're not going to get there. But that was a moment, right? You know, and then you go back to my grandparents' generation, having lived through the Great Depression and World War II. You know, we may be on a path to things that are worse than they are today, but we have agency in that, and things aren't the worst they've ever been. And there are signs of hope if you are willing to look for them. And then I would say, you know, one of my friends who was recently elected to the United States Senate, who's a fantastic person, if you want to follow somebody in U.S. politics right now on the progressive side, though kind of moderate progressive, a woman named Alyssa Slotkin, who is a senator from Michigan. You know, she talks a lot about, she's also a student of history, and she talks a lot about these moments of crisis and the things that have gotten at least the United States through these moments of crisis are leaders who are willing to step up and lead, and then citizens who are willing to do a little bit more than they usually have to do, right? And so look for those leaders. They're out there no matter where you live, even if you know the progressive party in your country only has 20% of the electorate, that means 20% of the people out there in politics are someone you might be able to believe in and support. And then look for the ways that you can do a little bit more, right? You know, I always feel better after I volunteer, right? I always feel better and more hopeful after I engage in some way. And you know, if you have the means and your system is one where you can contribute money, contribute money. If you can't contribute money, contribute time. If you can't contribute time, you know, use your platforms to share your ideas and your beliefs. You know, you will feel better if you go do a little something.
It's that action of, you know, getting your hands dirty, not, you know, being the man or the woman in the arena. Brent, I want to ask a question maybe specifically aimed at listeners to this podcast that are perhaps more in the beginning of their career. Maybe they've just recently joined career. And let's just chat about the politics of the long haul and longevity of career. I think what we often see, especially in younger leaders, is this kind of need to see immediate results in a world that really values immediacy and response, fast response. And as you said, you're probably going to lose more than you're going to win. So there's this awareness on the one hand that you're busy always with legacy building stuff, trying to kind of find the golden thread that is the execution of your values as you've done so successfully throughout your career. And on the other hand, kind of this awareness that it's going to take time and that sometimes you're going to have to stay put and stick it out and keep going. When should you not keep going? When should you leave? How do you know the difference? You know, what would you say to these young leaders who maybe have the urge to see results that they're not seeing right now and they're feeling frustrated by older generations in their own organizations? What view should they take on their career in politics?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack in there. We could do a whole podcast episode just on that. I mean, I will say, you know, like a couple different thoughts. I'll say, you know, first of all, just for someone who's just starting out in politics, there are no overnight successes. Every successful campaign, if you really dig in, has a history that goes back years, if not decades, right? Decisions that are made, people that are helped along the way. Again, you know, you look at President Obama, you know, yes, he had only been in the United States Senate for a few years, but there was a journey before that that got him there, right? It didn't start in 2007, right? And so, you know, understand that change takes time, that personal progress and kind of societal progress takes time. So I think just having some perspective. Now, having some perspective is not the same as being overly patient, right? You still, you know, one of the great things about politics is, I think, as a young person, it's one of the few fields, we talked about this earlier, where you can come in and you can make a personal impact very quickly. So, you know, be the person on the campaign or the person at the party headquarters or the person, you know, in your elected official's office who's willing to raise their hand and say, I'll take on that extra project. I'll do that extra thing. I'll come in on Saturday and work, right? Look for ways where you can have immediate impact. And so I'd say just from a career advice perspective, every opportunity I've gotten in my life, particularly in politics, is because, you know, I brought an attitude to the table of being the person who was willing to say, yes, I'll try that, even if it's something a little outside my comfort zone or something new. And then doing it the best you could, learning from that experience, and then seeing what doors that experience opens. So I guess that's the professional advice part. I think that the second part that's implied in the question is one, you know, we're struggling with here in the United States and the Democratic Party, which is this idea of, you know, when do you need or how do you foster generational change in politics? And you know, we have, you know, you look at the, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but, you know, the average age of a United States senator is well above the average age of an American working person, right? You know, we have people in positions of power who have been in those positions forever. You know, no offense to these folks. I think a lot of them are incredible public servants. But, you know, we are at a moment, and I think you saw this reflected in the New York City primary yesterday, where there is a desire in the rank and file of our party for a generational change. You know, I think some of that is, you know, we need to foster leadership who understands there is power and dignity in gracefully exiting to make room for the next generation. So I think that's a value that we need to focus on more as a party. And then I would say, look, you know, the electoral process, at least in the United States, is set up in such a way, like, if you don't like it, go primary, you know, get in the arena, be willing to run and lose. It may take a couple times, right? But the best way to send a signal, if you think that the generation in charge needs a change, is to challenge that generation. And we have a system to do that. And in many ways, you know, you look at what happened here in the United States in the last election with President Biden, who I have nothing but respect for. I mean, talk about a man who gave his life to public service. But you look at all the people that are now kind of second guessing whether he should have run again. None of those people primaried him. There wasn't a process in place for people to say, wait a second, I think we need a new generation of Democratic leadership. And so, you know, you can't be so precious about your own position and your relation to those people in power that if you truly believe there needs to be a change, you have to actually step up, maybe an agent of that change.
And let's say you're stepping into politics and you're standing wherever you are in the world, you're putting yourself forward as a candidate. How do you cultivate this ability not to care so much about what people say about you when you're, you know, you spoke earlier about this, you have to be authentic, you have to be yourself. So you're putting forward an offer as a contrast to what's currently on offer. Typically, you'll get some criticism.
Yeah.
How do you not care?
Yeah, I don't. That's a good question. I've never run for office, so clearly I haven't figured that out. But, you know, like it is, you know, there's a saying in the United States that politics is a contact sport, right? And so, you know, you have to understand that you're, you know, even if you win 51% of the vote, that means 49% of the people out there are saying no to you, right? So, you know, some of it is just cultivating in a healthy way, a healthy ego, right? And truly believing in what you're trying to get done. I think, you know, being grounded in values and grounded in trying to make progress makes it easier to take on those criticisms. I also think, you know, the best piece of advice I could give somebody who's trying to run for office is to surround yourself with good people, right? It's a team, right? It's a contact sport. It's also a team sport. You know, for every person that's on the ballot, there's a group of people that are around them who may not have put their name on the ballot, but have also committed their lives to public service and want that person to be successful. If you have a strong team around you, people who believe in you, you know, those people will help hold you up when you have those moments of criticism or those moments of questioning of whether you're doing what you're doing is the right thing. So, you know, in any job, the most important thing you do is hire people as a manager. As a politician, the most important thing you do is build that team around you that's going to help you be successful and is going to catch you when you're not successful.
It's a little bit like I once had a conversation with a colleague at the party I used to with Warwick Chapman. I think you may have met him. At one point we had a conversation with him and the question was asked him, what is one of the most important things you can do as a leader? And he had a similar answer about to become aware of the lens that you are looking at the world through which you are looking at the world. And that is as much dependent on the people that you surround yourself with and anything else. So perhaps on that.
Well, yeah. And sorry to interrupt, but I think the other piece is, you know, you talk about the long game in politics. You talk about how you have an impact over time. You know, those people that you bring in to work for you or the people who are sort of the super volunteers, that's also building a legacy. You know, we were lucky enough to have, you know, all of the folks or a lot of the folks who worked on the two Obama campaigns and in the Obama administration together in Chicago just a couple years ago for the 15th anniversary of the first campaign of the 2008 election. And, you know, President Obama and Mrs. Obama were on stage and they talked quite a bit about how, you know, they're so proud of what they did in those 8 years in the White House. But their true legacy is the people that worked for them who have now gone on and run for office. You know, we now have folks who were staff members on that campaign who are, you know, in prominent positions in state government, important states like California, people who got on to run for United States Senate, the United States Congress. You know, that's building those people around you, creating that alumni network, that's a way where you can exit the stage and still have an impact, right? And still have this sense of generational change that you're part of. And, you know, I hope that politicians see that as something that they should foster and that they should be incredibly proud of. It's just as important as any legislative accomplishment that they have.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I wish I could invent a time machine and go back. But I mean, what I love about what you've said is this, I think the word that comes to mind for me is perspective. So when you step back and you look at your impact from a broader perspective, not just what you as an individual are able to achieve, but what you enabled others to achieve around you. And we find examples in the past, as we very much can with the Obama campaign. I'd love to hear if we think about our own lens of hope at the moment and how we see the world and those examples of impact. You mentioned this new Senator Alyssa Slotkin as an example of someone who's doing something different or something hopeful. I'd love to hear if you have where you see other examples of unexpected hope in the world, whether it's a movement or an organization or an individual in the States, outside the States. Yeah. What are current examples of hope that we can seek out?
Yeah. You know, I probably look a little bit closer to home and in general and to look probably through the political lens, just because that's the world that I came up in. And I do, you know, it's you know, going back to what we were joking about at the beginning, you know, getting a little older, you have this really bizarre experience of having friends and colleagues who all of a sudden are truly important people. So, you know, we're in these, you know, you used to work with these people who are running for office and all of a sudden it's your friends that are in office. So I look, Alyssa's a fantastic example. There's a fantastic senator in New Jersey, a gentleman named Andy Kim, the first Korean American elected to the United States Senate. Both of them, interestingly enough, come out of a national security background. Both of them served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, not in uniform, but supporting the military. There's a fantastic woman who's also a good friend named Buffy Wicks in California, who just became the head of the, Buffy's going to kill me because I'm forgetting her position. But she's, you know, one of the two or three people in leadership in the state assembly for the Democratic Party. So, you know, I think that there are, and look, there are local versions, no matter where you are, of people that I happen to be lucky enough to know who've gone on to elected office. And so I think finding individuals who you can believe in and align with is important. You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see you know, the reactions, particularly here in the United States, I think you're already starting to see some, you know, people within the arts community pushing back and starting to have more of a voice in our current situation. So the arts are always a good place to look for hope. And then, I don't know. It's you know, one of the things I feel so lucky about, you know, I was, you know, brought to have a relationship with the two of you through our friend Lindoy Mozabuco, who, you know, for many of your listeners may know, has played a role in South African politics now for years. And, you know, finding those ways to find people in other countries or in other contexts that are doing the things that you are doing in your context. I think the more you can create connections, both at the hyperlocal and at the global level, the more you're going to have a network of people that can help lift you up in those moments of despair. And you're going to learn a lot from people and you're going to be a lot more hopeful.
And I think that's really sorry, Clinton.
No, go for it.
That's the magic of the listeners of this podcast, is being part of this global family of freedom-loving people around the world, often in challenging circumstances, but having gone through the same experience at this academy that they've been lucky enough to go to. And I think, you know, it's one thing to have this experience, but the second step really is to cultivate the network and to continue cultivating the network. And certainly in my experience, and Brent, I'm not sure whether this is the same for you, but as you get older, it's so easy to just get kind of stuck in the organization that you find yourself in the city where you find yourself, in your circle with your group of friends. It takes effort to reach out and to schedule coffees and to connect online, but it is also, those are the sources of hope and connection.
That's right. And learning. I mean, I think that, you know, in some ways the most powerful leadership quality that is often overlooked is the power of listening, right? And so I think, and again, as you get older, it's harder to listen. You think you kind of know how things are, you know, it's easier just to fall into habits and patterns. But, you know, the moments like these in progressive politics, when we are not in power, are the moments we need to be listening as much as we're talking. And so, you know, finding folks to learn from, finding folks to engage with, those can be peers, those can be, you know, people older than you, those can be people younger than you, right? But, you know, having your ears open and being open to having those conversations, even if they challenge your assumptions, is incredibly important. And it's going to be an incredibly important part of getting us back and headed in the right direction.
Especially if they challenge your assumptions. I always feel like that's almost the secret message, that now is the time to really listen when something is triggering for you. If not about the topic, then certainly something about yourself can be learned.
Yeah, it comes back to this awareness of like the lens that you're in, and whether you surround yourself with people that can challenge your lens, that can challenge your view in that. But it is amazing, as you were talking now, it's almost like I also got reminded of how even just like a simple conversation that you have, but it's one of those really thoughtful, deep conversations where you learned something about yourself or you really broke new ground. There are these conversations that I bring up in my memory in the last few years that have really stood out as moments of hope. And it doesn't have to be in these big movements, political movements, or, you know, people achieving, you know, great men and women theory thing. Sometimes it sort of takes place just in a conversation or in a relationship that you have with someone. And that what comes out for me from this is having the first, I suppose, the awareness, and then also the intention to recognize those moments and those relationships, and then to cultivate them and to be specific and intentional about growing them over time.
That's right. Yeah. And look, I think, you know, just coming back to the idea of hope really quickly, as you know, as we wrap things up, is you know, ultimately hope is just the belief that something can be different, right? That the world can be different. And you know, so many things we take for granted today. My wife and I happened to be talking last night about we keep coming back to the results in New York, and all of the things that were proposed in that election. You know, we'll see if any of those things are accomplished. But you think about things in the United States that are now taken for granted, like Social Security, which is the program in the United States that basically makes sure that folks, as they head into their later years, are supported. That was an unimaginable government program before it was put into place under FDR. Now it is an assumed thing to the point where neither party can attack it, right? And so you'd have to have this ability to imagine that something actually can be different. Now, if you just stop with that imagining, that's not enough. You then have to figure out, okay, how can I go contribute to making that world that I can imagine actually true and actually come to life? And I think that's the trick, right? That's the trick as a citizen, and that's the trick as a leader, is how do you take people on that journey?
Brent, is there anything that you're reading at the moment that's that you want to recommend to our listeners?
I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm not going to do something I'm currently reading, but just given the topic today, there's a fantastic book that I find myself going back to quite a bit. It's called When We Rise by Cleve Jones. And Cleve was one of Harvey Milk's lieutenants, so was very much at the forefront of the gay rights movement here in the United States. And look, if you think about, you know, a journey, think about our brothers and sisters in the LGBTQ community. You know, in the 1980s, at the height of the AIDS epidemic, the idea that you could hit a button and fast forward 20 years and that you would be in a world where not only would we have tackled HIV, but we would be, you know, allowing same-sex marriage in the puritanical United States of America, and that, you know, this would be a culturally accepted part of the fabric of American life. You know, that is a journey of hope, right? And that is a journey of being able to imagine a future that seems unimaginable. So, you know, and Cleve was right at the center of all of that. So I would encourage everybody who's at all interested in politics in general. It's one of my favorite political books. So it's called When We Rise by Cleve Jones.
Thank you, Brent. And I think this is a good point to bring our conversation to a close. This incredibly rich, dense conversation on hope. But what struck me about it was that, you know, it's not a conversation about a passive hope. It's a conversation about staring reality in the face and not being afraid to, despite reality, step in, make a difference, and spend some energy cultivating the support and the relationships we need on the side to keep going. I really want to appreciate you as somebody that's such an example of that, and for being willing to have that conversation with us today.
I couldn't agree more. And in that spirit, you know, anybody out there listening, if there's anything I can do to help, you can find me on LinkedIn. You know, the two of you know how to get a hold of me. So, you know, happy to help. Please reach out.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you, Brent.
Generous.
Yeah, and I'm sure you will be found on LinkedIn.
Yeah, you've just opened up a can of worms. You have no idea.
Bring it
on. So this episode forms a part of the IAF podcast series, as all of you know, that accompanies regular seminar programs of the International Academy for Leadership in Germany. We encourage you to listen to all the episodes, including those that are to follow during the course of this year. And please share your thoughts in response, your thoughts and ideas. Till next time.